Welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, the president of the Hall of Fame, and as we continue our journey through some of the qualities and attributes that are central to tennis, today we focus on leadership with two individuals who are leaders both on and off the court.
Even in a relationship, in a couple, sometimes there's a leader in a couple, so it's not compulsory. There are some teams who are a bit more balanced dealing, but most of the team have either an energy leader or a tactical leader, and sometimes they have both.
The most important part was listening, trying to understand the different issues. The way I saw tennis doesn't mean that the guy next to me saw the same way. So for me, it was building common opinion, common objectives.
We say often, if we don't see that, we come on together, which means like we win as a team together, we lose as a team together. But the main thing is together.
You cannot win every fight. You cannot win every argument. So the players need to be explained why.
If every time his partner is disappointed, frustrated, or because there are emotions related to the past, like anger or frustration, or emotion related to the future, anxious, and the leader will find that and help the partner and the team to stay in the present.
People have tendency to have strong opinion without getting informations. And for me, leadership really is getting informations, listening, understanding, and then obviously take decisions, which is then the most important part of the leader.
The voices of doubles coach Louis Caille and Roger Federer's former coach Ivan Ljubicic. Let's start with Ljubicic. The Croat is one of the most experienced and eloquent men in tennis. He got to number 3 in the world as a player and was a Davis Cup champion and a Grand Slam semifinalist. During his playing career, he spent 6 years on the ATP Player Council and just over a year on the ATP board, following a highly successful spell coaching Roger Federer to his last 3 major titles. He's now working with the French Tennis Federation's young professionals. Chris Bowers spoke to Ljubicic specifically about leadership in tennis.
Ivan, leadership is an interesting concept because it involves getting ahead of the interests that get reflected in politics. How did your concept of leadership get shaped by the 6 years you were on the ATP Player Council, in particular the 2 years you were president?
Well, my first objective was trying to get as many players together and get their trust. The most important part was listening, trying to understand the different issues. The way I saw tennis doesn't mean that the guy next to me saw the same way. So for me, it was building a common opinion, common objectives, where to push. And of course, the most important part was pick up your fights, you know, understand what are the priorities, don't get confused by non-important things. And I think it was, honestly, back then, it was kind of beginning what we see today, where the players get involved. And I remember right then, Roger, Rafa and Novak also got involved, and they were members of the Player Council. I think that was really the most important part when we talk about player representation and politics in our sport, where the players really kind of told everyone, we want to know what's happening, and we want to try to understand, because it's not easy, and especially we want our voice to be heard. So it was beginning of something. Then leadership, obviously, you know, there are so many issues. Once I started to be part of the Player Council, I understood so many things that I didn't know as a player, and that's the same as you move on. I mean, today I work for a French Federation, and you know, when you sit in the meeting room and you get all those informations, you all of a sudden understand how little you knew before. So, and you have to try to simplify, you have to try to be clear with everybody and explain yourself. And I think that's really, really important, because people have tendency to have strong opinion without getting informations. And for me, leadership really is getting informations, listening, understanding, and then obviously take decisions, which is then the most important part of the leader.
I mean, we're talking about, you're on the ATP Player Council 2002 to 2008. You're dealing with a lot of 20-somethings, mm-hmm. people who haven't maybe seen that much of the world. You had issues to deal with, like the introduction of the whereabouts rule or experimentations with not just having knockout competitions on these pools of three players, an experiment that didn't last very mm-hmm. long. Obviously, every player has their own personal interests. How much were you able to say there may be things that you're not happy with, but they are for the good of the sport?
But the players, they have opinions, but most... The more importantly, they need to understand. They need to understand why. I think there is a general opinion that the players don't want to listen. That they don't. They have strong opinions, which is true. But the most important part is sit with the players and explain them and explain them also decision making process and also the reasoning why certain decisions were made. And of course, the experiment of round robin of three. I was against it while sitting as the president president of the player council back then. But sometimes you have to accept also the decisions that you don't agree with in order to understand and, you know, move on. And as I said, you know, you cannot win every fight. You cannot win every argument. So the players need to be explained why. It's not decision itself, of course, it's very, very important. But more than that, I think the players needed, and they still do, they need to be explained why certain decisions are made, what is the logic behind it. And then, of course, it's much easier for certain players to accept maybe decisions that they don't agree with.
Okay, so the players need to understand why, but are the players willing to understand why? Are they receptive to explanations, or do they have entrenched views that are difficult to dislodge?
Some do, some don't. You know, of course, as in every community, you know, you have a number of them that they want to get involved, they want to understand. They are. You know, they give you ideas, and others they just complain, and you have to deal with all of them. You have to understand that some are just destructive; they are just not happy, and you also need to understand the moment when you speak to them. It's not that right after the match that they just lost, but you will never ever get everybody on board. It's just not possible because there are so many different issues, and the interest of every player is different. But that's why it's very important to kind of see the big picture and the brave new world that was introduced from Etienne Devilliers, who was the president back then. It was a huge change in the ATP world, and it was in the end accepted, and I think was a success. But it was not easy because there were so many details within this project that, you know, the players didn't agree with, that I personally didn't agree with. But you have to look at it as a whole.
Your successor as ATP Player Council president was Roger Federer. How were you a different leader to Roger?
Well, but this I don't know because I then became a board member after that. So I don't know how he was with other players, but he's a very smart person. He has a big aura, of course, and he's a good listener. And I believe, you know, that he obviously was able to get on board most of the players. Of course, probably he had a little less time for other players than me. But I think that looking back, that was really, really important period of the player representation because the players really liked a lot the fact that, you know, the top three were there and they were there for the best of the game. And that's where really big things happen. You know, the players felt represented at the highest possible level. Before then, the top players were not interested in politics, and that really changed that.
Which begs the question, do leaders in tennis have to be from the top of the game? I mean, you were top three, you were Grand Slam semi-finalist, because tennis is a meritocracy, and therefore you're only as good as your results.
Player council is structured in a way that you have representatives of every group, geographically, ranking-wise, doubles, players. So it's really well thought in terms that you really need to have representative who understands the issue of every group that we have. Of course, then you have one president who then the player council actually elects the president who is good. But in the end, the president, it's not somebody who has more power than others. He's just the leader. He's just a spokesperson, let's say, who is going to, you know, talk to the presidents or the board member if there is need that one person only speaks to them. So the president doesn't have extra power. is just representing all other council members.
Yes, but if Roger Federer says, look, guys, I know we don't like the whereabouts rule, having to say where we are for 3 months, but actually we have to do this for the goodness of the sport, surely that's going to have far more power coming from somebody who is world number one than if it was a very eloquent player who'd never got beyond 70.
Yes, but Roger's opinion, it's very important, him being a president or not. So the fact that he was a president, I think, was also important, because then he has official role. And you know, it's not just his opinion, but it's actually in that role he's representing all the players. So that's why I thought was important that he is actually the president.
You've mentioned that you went on to the ATP board. Obviously, that's more of a management function than ATP Player Council, which is slightly a spokesperson or trade union. How did your view of leadership change through the year and a bit that you were on the ATP board?
I understood a lot more about the business of the game. For me, the biggest lesson I learned from that period was that in the meeting room with the board of directors, we had strong arguments. We had really some heated exchanges. The moment we went out, you know, we had absolutely normal relationship, if not friendly, you know, between, you know, the other board members or even the president, Etienne de Villiers, back then. So that was really game changer for me in terms of understanding that you can separate the business from personal relationship. And for me, it was a huge learning moment. But yes, it was. There were so many issues and the points that, you know, kind of were too much for me in terms of I didn't have enough knowledge. I had to ask advice from the experts, legal experts, financial experts. You know, because you are sitting there, you have a vote, you have really huge responsibility. I really had to make sure that I don't make big mistakes, because mistakes you make. But the difficult part is really, I mean, receiving, you know, between 50 and 100 emails every day, going through every email with a lot of care, because you never know which one is the one that could become tricky or could become an issue. I did it for some time, as you said. Then eventually it was just too much, you know, to being active player and to sit at the board. It was just a little bit too much.
But was there the leadership skills in the ATP board that when you had a heated discussion, the decision for the interests of tennis would eventually come out, or were there too many vested interests? I don't want you to talk about specific interests, because that's not fair. But, you know, it's obviously people have their corners that they fight, which may not necessarily be for the best interest of tennis.
Yeah, but I was sitting there representing the players from Europe, right? That was my official role, director of the board, representing tennis players, professional players from Europe. And then you have an issue of all the players together, and then you have an issue of the game as such. Then you have the ATP issue or together with WTA. So there you have so many different interests that it's very important to be able to understand, as I said earlier, what the priority is. And I always felt the priority is the game. Right, it's not the issue of European player in his clay court tournaments in the summer. It's not, you know, that's important, of course, but it's a small issue compared to where our sport is going. So when you change these hats, you know, when you're representing the players or you're representing one specific group of players, sometimes it's tricky, right, to understand that the small issue, it's not the most important issue, but actually the big issue is how do we grow the sport? And I felt that we didn't have enough of these conversations, how do we grow the sport? It was always, you know, interest of the smaller groups that would pull, you know, in one direction. And I felt like we were distracted by that. I felt like we as a sport, we need to do better. I think tennis is the most global sport in the world, together with the football, soccer, you know, I don't know where you're listening this, but you know what I'm talking about. But we are too separated to be able to take the most out of what we are offering and what the people are interested in. We need to simplify, that's for sure. But, you know, of course, an opinion, it's one thing. To actually do it, it's completely different.
Okay, which brings me on to the fact that there are seven major power entities in tennis, the four Grand Slams, the ITF, the ATP and the WTA. We're in a phase where they are actually cooperating much more than they once were with each other. But is the leadership of tennis still scattered?
It is scattered. I mean, and I honestly don't see how that will change. What I'm happy and proud to see that, you know, as you said, there is more communication between them. I do believe that our sport is going in the right direction. It's never going to be ideal. It's never going to be perfect. But I think the players especially need to understand that some things just take time. I knew back then in 2000, whatever, 6, 7, 8, you know, I knew that all the decisions and the energy that I put in was not for me. It's for the generations to come. And today, what we see in 2025, where our sport is, it's not for me personally. And this is really, really difficult for the players to understand that the effort and the energy that they put in, it's actually not for them directly, but for the sport. I knew, you know, I knew that I would stay in the sport. I knew that I was going to be doing something else once I retire. I didn't know what exactly, of course. But if you love this sport, if you really appreciate everything that this sport is giving, every single member of this entity, as you said, should be thinking, you know, how do we grow this sport? How do we make this better? The players are very, very, very important. I heard many people saying, yes, but players are temporary. True. But the players are also the ones who are going to stay in the game for 50 years. Yes, they will play for 10, 15, 20, the longest one. But they will stay in the sport and they will want to be involved. So whatever we do today, we need to think, how do we make this sport better? So to come back to your original question, yes, it is better. Yes, we have to do better. But it's not easy. It's not easy because it's easy to break something, but to build it back together, it's very, really difficult.
One idea that comes up at fairly regular intervals is the idea of a tennis commissioner, one person responsible for tennis. If one could find the right person, do you think that is a potential improvement in the leadership of the sport?
It's just too much power in one person, I think. And also what kind of power he will have, because we have a president of the ATP today and he doesn't have a power. You know, he's just one of the nine votes at the ATP. So yes, he is a leader. He is, as I said, spokesperson. He is the one who is going to push for a vision, but he doesn't have superpower, right? So we don't talk in the sports in the sport like this. We can name the commissioner, but needs to be clear to everybody that this person will not have superpower. He will not be able to say, I want this, and then everybody will just follow. So I'm not sure. I think what I would love to see is that the entities are sitting together, that they speak even more so together, and they try to grow the sport. To have one person who is going to sit on top of this group of seven entities, yeah, maybe. But I don't think it's the thing that will change our sport. I think what will really change is that, you know, there are more meetings and the priorities are clear and that everybody's pushing in the same direction.
You've talked about how the efforts that you put in are not for today's players, therefore tomorrow's players. So as a player, as a former ATP Player Council president, board member, now involved in player development with the French Federation, commentating for Italian television, do you have a sense of what tennis will look like 25, 30 years from now based on the efforts that are being put into the leadership of today's tennis?
It's hard to say. I mean, people talk about the calendar, right? It's very long, and I agree. It's 11 months a year. Yes, as a player representative, I always fought for the mandatory tournaments, right? So these are the ones that hurt the most, where the players are, they have to show up and they have to perform. This has changed dramatically in the last 15, 20 years. When I broke through in the late 90s, you know, we didn't have mandatory tournaments. You had big tournaments, but you didn't have to show up. Now the players are really forced to play basically all the big events. So I think but as a player representative, I understood that in order to grow the sport, the tournaments had to know that certain players will show up. So where is this going? I don't know. I believe that, you know, there will be some change eventually in terms of commitment from the players towards the tour. It is stretched a little bit too much now, the idea of 2 weeks Masters 1000s. I understand the logic behind it. I'm not sure it's showing to be a huge success for the players, for the tournaments, absolutely, because, you know, they can sell more tickets and they are having their events longer than before. For the players, physically, it's much easier because they don't play every day, but mentally, you have to stay around for much longer. So I think there will be some changes in, I don't know, 5-10 years from now. But I don't think the Slams are going anywhere. The Masters 1000 will try to catch up. They will try to grow. And the finals will be there. So I don't expect really huge changes in the future of our game unless Armageddon happens and then we have to, you know, start from scratch. But the tour looks like this since basically the beginning. So I have no reason to think that in 25 years from now, the tour will look dramatically different than what it is today.
Ivan Ljubicic, and what an asset he is to the game of tennis. It's interesting how he kept getting back to the topic of growing the sport, and he wishes there were more conversations about that. Ljubicic was focusing on leadership of tennis in general, but what of leadership on court? If you take a look at the current men's doubles rankings, you'll see an astonishing number of British players. The leading pair in 2025 are an all-British team of Julian Cash and Lloyd Glasspool, but they're not alone. In fact, at times, there have been 7 British players in the world's top 35, such as Henry Patton, Neil Skupski, Joe Salisbury, Luke Johnson, and Jamie Murray. Now, each one is a personal success story, but there's one common factor, and that's Louis Caillé, a Canadian coach specializing in doubles. He works with Great Britain's doubles players, adults and juniors, to improve their cohesion as partnerships. Chris asked Caillé if there could be leadership in a two-man team.
But it's still a team, and every time you have a team, even in a relationship, in a couple, sometimes there's a leader in a couple, so there is. It's not compulsory. There are some teams who are a bit more balanced dealing, but most of the team have either an energy leader or a tactical leader, and sometimes they have both. So what is a tactical leader? It's mostly on the changeover, the person who see, oh, look, at this is happening, you know, they play that too often, let's do this, let's do that. And there's some people have what we call more tennis IQ. They feel more, they anticipate more, and then they take the leadership of that, and that's fine. What is the energy leader is the one who has unconditional high positive energy, which is the prerequisite to peak performance state. And whatever happened, losing, winning, he playing bad, whatever, they will always like jump on the court and provide energy, rescue their partner if they start to be negative. So that's it. And most of the British team, there's often a leader. And I ask one of the leading team, because we have like right now 3 teams in the top 7 in the world, how he perceive his role as a leader. So I took
some notes. You actually nominate a leader?
Very often I suggest a leader, yes, because they have to accept the role. But very often they trust me and they trust my judgment, and I feel like someone should be either the energy of everything, leader and tactical, or just energy or just tactical. Yeah, very often I nominate. So that person, which I prefer to that name, say that he sees his role in 5 ways as a leader. First, he say role model, because what you do speaks louder than your words. So if I'm negative and I ask my partner to be positive, it won't work. So a strong role model, which is understand. He says to be vocal. Come on, let's go. Let's go to his partner. Let's go. And always be sure he raise energy and be heard. It's good for the team, but also it has an impact on the opponents. We know even ourselves, like when someone in front is very vocal, it does have a little influence. So they're aware of that and they do it. Of course, he sees his role as a leader as rescuing his partner. If every time his partner is disappointed, frustrated, or because there are emotions related to the past, like anger or frustration, or emotion related to the future, anxious, and the leader will find that and help the partner and the team to stay in the present. You know, the classic point by point, it's a cliche, but there's obviously a lot of truth into that. He sees also that his role probably as a tactical leader is to adapt to what's going on. And it's an important belief that we have that whatever happened, we can handle it. so they will see what's going on. Or it could be something like, even if it's very windy, so let's do more of that, or whatever. Whatever happened, he can handle it, he can adapt, and that's a very strong belief to have. And finally, he sees himself like being assertively calm. Assertive is the in the middle between like being aggressive, we don't want that. Being passive, we don't want that. So what do we want? We want someone assertive and calm. So when he talks, it's not like raising energy by getting excited. Okay, come on. It's not like getting excited. It's okay, let's go like this one, and kind of a calm assertiveness.
And this is an experienced player who, yeah, you don't want to name him, but he's somebody you've nominated as a leader of his pair.
Yeah, exactly. And he accepts his role, and he knows he plays that role quite well. So it's role model, big vocal, rescue partner, adapt to whatever happened, and be assertively calm. That's how he sees himself. But it's not me who define these qualities. I name them, and they embed the qualities they feel they need to be a leader.
Okay, so what happens if the leader is a young player, he's extrovert, and his partner is a more experienced player but a bit more introvert? Are you not going to have clashes there in terms of the experience as against the personality?
No, it didn't happen, because, of course, we talked to the team, so that experienced introvert know that I nominate that person, and it's unconditional, high positive energy, unconditional, you know what it means, there's no excuse. And very often that introvert enjoy the energy and understand that without it, the team would not be as good.
Okay, so what happens if you have two players of equal temperament? One thinks of the Bryans. I know you haven't coached the Bryans, but you know, identical twins, same temperament. How do you deal with that kind of situation? Who's the leader then?
I'm not so sure they were having exactly the same temperament, but there's one. I don't want to name who I think was leading, because it may get to them and they may not like it or disagree with it. But I think there is. And when there's a disagreement on the leader, very often the team doesn't work. And that's why you don't play well with everybody. There's some pairing that match much better than other pairing. And I think when people know their roles, accept their roles, and are comfortable in their roles, the team can have a better chemistry.
So can the leader change in the course of a match? If a player's having a bad day, can the player who's not the leader sort of just take over?
Unconditional positive energy. It means he has a bad day, he still provides energy, because he says, if I play bad, I should not make my partner play bad. So I'm going to keep that energy and ensure that he plays well enough to make us go through that round, and next round I'll play better. And also they know that by being in the present, things are always temporary. So you play bad in the first set, doesn't mean you're going to play bad in the second set. I mean, you know, you've seen tennis, can lose the first set 6-1 and win the next one 6-2. And then the third one is wide open to whoever performed better. So it's temporary, so there's no panic. The leader doesn't panic, and he helps his partner to stay on the right track.
You said at the beginning that you sometimes appoint an energy leader and a tactical leader. You've talked a lot about the energy leader, the unconditional positivity. Yeah. What about the tactical leader?
Tactical leader could change. Sometimes it's the same one. But very often the players I work with are both quite astute tactically. And it will be more like a discussion. They communicate together. So lately it's more about the unconditional positive energy. In the past, I used to make a tactical leader. This time, I'll name him. Because when Joe Salisbury started with Rajiv Ram, Rajiv was much more experienced than him, maybe 6 years older. And, of course, I say, Joe, listen to Rajiv on the changeover. Rajiv, you're going to lead the team. You have much more experience and stuff like this. But as they grow together, it became like a genuine communication. They play 6 years together very successfully, and then it became more like we discussed tactics instead of one lead with tactics.
So in that, was Rajiv the energy leader and Joe Salisbury the tactical leader?
No, in that case, sorry Joe, but it was Rajiv both the energy leader and the tactical leader. He had more experience, and I told him, if you want to have success with the team, you have to access his role. he was older, he was introvert in his life, and on court he accepted his role, and he did agree because they just split last year. You know, they have a record of a historical record of winning 3 U.S. Open in a row. He did agree that that was essential to the team and that it made him play even better himself. So
is Joe Salisbury now he has a different partner. He plays with Neil Skupski. Does that mean he's playing a different role? Is he a leader in that team? Or are these the sort of details you don't want to go into?
But now you're getting a bit into it. But okay, let's say it. Neil Skupski has a role to be energy leader, but doesn't mean that Joe is passive and he just like follow the leader. I think Joe will bring energy too. But if one has to be, they both have to be unconditional now. But just by his demeanor, just by the way he is on the court, Neil Skupski brings that energy even a bit more. But they're quite a real team, and for tactics they discuss all the time in the changeover or even during the points. So they're good friends, two good players. They both have been number one in 2022, so they both like very, very experienced and accomplished doubles players who can have a genuine conversation about tactics.
Now, one of the things that you are known for is having encouraged the person who didn't lose a point to go straight over to their partner and say, you know, right, come on, next one. Yeah. Has that survived the leadership model? I mean, do you sometimes find that even if the leader has missed a volley or missed a return, that he will be the one that goes over to his partner and says, right, come on, next one?
Yes, I think that will be achieved. Because even if it's a leader, I have to propose some behavioral expression of that. And it's partner first, ball second. And to a point that Andy Barnes, coach under 14 or under 12 national, have put a rule, which I like. It was a three-second rule. You have 3 seconds to go to your partner and to team as a team. And I've seen video of our under 12 girls playing internationally. And on 72 matches, they won 69. And it's a joke how they look like a team. They're always bubbly together, and you see in front two girls who look like separate on their own, playing singles, whatever it is. If you see the video, you will be, wow. It's a night and day, the difference in the high positive energy on the court. They go to the bench together. They get up together. It's nice to see.
So this three-second rule is basically, once the point is lost, one person goes to the other within 3 seconds and touches hands or just says, come on.
Yeah, exactly. Communicate or let's go, it's okay, or it was a nice shot. Or they don't have to say all the time the same word or it will be meaningless. So they communicate with energy, with words. They just team. Like we say often, if we don't see it happen, come on, together, which means like we win as a team together, we lose as a team together. But the main thing is together.
You talk a lot about unconditionality, unconditional positivity. Can that go too far? Can that become over-aggressive?
I don't think it could be over-aggressive. I think it could maybe look fake at some point. But
how do you avoid that?
But I see that more in the other teams. Because the other teams, too, don't have that. And some are deliberate, like they will scream when they lose, like, come on, to try to change the momentum, energy momentum. The opponents do that more than we do, but occasionally one of our players is good at doing that, and it does change energy. The opponents say, wow, they're not going down here, they're going to fight. And I don't think we use that in terms of aggressivity. I think it's become quite natural. When you play that role quite a lot, it's like a comedian, whatever, it's just become kind of natural.
Can you pick one or two great players from history who've been exemplary doubles leaders?
One that I have in mind, because I was showing him to some Brits when I was starting here, it was like Pace.
Leander Pace.
Indian. He would change partner. He would take a guy who was 17 in the world and they will win a slam together. Then he will take another guy who was perceived like others, like quite average, and they will win a slam together. And he was the one with the energy. He was the one calling, even sometimes play-by-play, telling his partner, return line there, of course, not to the opponent's ear, it, you know, through signals or to whatever. He was dictating the points. He was really like a real good leader. And of course, if you're, you may not want to play with someone who tells you what to do, something like this, but sometimes when an average guy is asked by a top player to play, they say yes, and if they accept the leadership, then they do very well. So pace is one coming in mind, and I'm sure there's a lot of good leader on the teams, but I prefer to focus on my teams, and on every team there's a good leader, and we're doing very well.
So just picking up on Leander Pace, if he is such an obvious leader to the point where he will often even talk about where to return the ball, do you find that that is a kind of player who has to be matched up with a certain personality or it won't work? I mean, two Leander Paces would not work, would they?
Absolutely no. Pace once played with Andy Murray. It was funny. He said, Andy, I hope you understand that they're going to play more on you if we're both at the net, right? So these type of course, that make Andy laugh because it was not a long-term relationship. It was just one match, but for sure it would not have worked. It would have not have worked with someone who knows the game even better and is a strong leader and strong character. No, it has the personality have to match, and that's why it's not every relationship that works. Sometimes top team split, two of the top players goes together, it doesn't work at all. They play 2-3 years, 2-3 months maximum, and they split again. No, the personality have to match.
A lot of club players and public parks players watch tennis on the television or maybe at stadiums, and they want to pick up things from the professionals that they can use to improve their own game. What can your leadership model within a doubles pair do to help club and public parks players?
I think the a lot of members, like you say, they just look at the point, the nice volley. I think it would be nice if they look after the point is over at that communication they have, how they go in the chair, how they speak together, how they get up, sprint, or let's say I play with you, we talk on the baseline, where you're going to serve, what I'm going to do, then I make a little sprint to the net to get the energy, then I sprint a little jog, and to maintain that high positive energy. And on the other end, also, a lot of members are taking clinics on doubles with coaches, and coach should encourage that. I know when I was working with club members, first lesson was, how will you celebrate? Fist pump, claps, high five, racket, nudge, and all this, because you're going to communicate between points and everything. And they were enjoying it. They were feeling more that they were playing as a team. Also, the coach could facilitate that discussion. And I was having that with members. What do you want your partner to tell you when you're not playing well? What do you want to hear from your partner? What you don't want to hear? And there was good communication and say, I hate when you say don't give up. I never give up. I hate that. It feels like you think I'm giving up. Don't tell that to me anymore. Okay, what do you want to tell me? Okay, come on, let's go. Next one. Okay, I'll say that. No problem. So there was more example in that, but that's one is enough. So they say what they don't want to hear and what they want to hear. And it's good. I think we have to realize the model we have in Great Britain is we coach a performer and we coach a tennis player. And the performer is the most important thing, is the head, heart, and legs, the mental, emotional, and physical aspect of tennis. If you don't have that, even if you hit the ball well, you know how to play. If you don't perform in a match and on the head, like you focus on the wrong thing, aren't you, you get anxious, nervous, or the word choking, and or you're not fit and you get tired or you don't move your feet, but you cannot play well. You cannot play well, so we really focus on that. And this is why we put the unconditional energy leader, you know, like to have a clear mind, great heart, and great energy, great legs. And matter of fact, in our international level, if the performer is not there, we have all the video stats on the match. We don't go through that because it's irrelevant. Why to mention like you miss that many backhand, or why to say that this, or technically you didn't poach enough or whatever. You were just not there. You didn't compete. You didn't have energy. You were whatever it is, you were angry, you were frustrating, you were flat. We won't go through a tennis. It will be looking at false reasons for the performance. And when you're strict with that, like I was, like once you were not a performer, I didn't go to the video stats. I said, no point. I do that the second time. They really realized I was not joking. And it creates a bit like, you know, you don't put a rule without a consequence, right? Otherwise, it doesn't work. Then it has helped pretty much all the Brits. If you watch them playing doubles, they all have that great energy. They show up for each match, and that explains quite well the results, success that they have.
So would you say that even if two club players are just playing a club match on a Sunday morning, that it's still right for them to have a few minutes chatting beforehand to work out how they're going to celebrate, what one person says to the other, who the energy leader is? Is it worth it even at that level?
It's a bit, first of all, when you do it once. So you don't have to do it before every match. So let's say it's the first time we play together. We'll have to decide who serves first. We cannot wait So we discuss who serves first. We decide which side we're going to return. So there has to be discussion for the first time, but we don't have to do that every time, unless it was so unsuccessful that we say, okay, let's change sides next time. But otherwise, it's done just once. If you know the opponents, you could discuss how you're going to play them, because you may know them, I may not know, so you're going to give me informations. Or if we both don't know them, we say, okay, let's start by doing this. Do you like to poach a lot? Do you like to do? Can you do eye formation? I would say no, bad knees. I don't want to crouch. Okay, so we'll play regular. So we'll have a basic normal discussion at a club level who knows a bit tennis. Now, if you're two big hitters, you just go and say, okay, let's go there and have fun. And you still have to decide which side you play and who serves first. And that's it. But more your advance, even as a club members, the discussion could be a tiny bit. This is my strength. This is what I like to do. I love a lot. Are you fine with that? And yeah, I think it's normal. We communicate before going to a match that is meaningful. If we just go to play for fun, we meet together and say, we play Joe and John there. You know, we just step on the court, but we'll still have to decide who serves first and on which side we play. So there's always a basic initial conversation. Then the depth in which we go depends if it's a competitive match, like playing in a league, or just a friendly match.
The Canadian coaching guru, Louis Caillé, talking with Chris Bowers. Now, there will be people who'll say his approach risks maybe overthinking it. And I'm not sure there was a team leader when Jim Grab and I played on the tour, or any unconditional eye positivity. And yet we still, somehow, won the French Open. But there's no question that Louis Caillé's results speak for themselves. And I hope there's something you could take from that interview that can enhance your doubles, either when you play yourself or in watching top-level doubles. Caillé also highlighted Leander Paes in that conversation, and we have a full and fascinating interview with the Indian Hall of Famer in the Tennis Worthy podcast series. I invite you to go to tennisfame.com/podcast. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm President Patrick McEnroe. Thanks for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to tell your friends about it to help us continue to grow the show and bring you even more compelling conversations. Bye-bye for now.